Following is part two of Father John Hardin's talk on the development of the religious life after first profession. Father Hardin.
Then number eight, which you refer to, brother, and I want to stress it. Part of this development after first profession is coping with the example of one's fellow religious. In the residences where necessarily, unless it's just a one residence community, of which there are almost none that I know of, after the first vows. Here I'd make a number of suggestions. First of all, I think major superiors should pay much more attention, and I think they commonly do, to this matter of example. I almost hesitate calling it bad example. It is bad, relatively speaking, because it's often bad for the young religious. It may not be all that bad objectively, but subjectively, it looks bad. And by the time you find out the religious isn't all that bad whose example I'm dissatisfied by, it may be too late. The young person may have taken up practices or given up things which are to be done because he or she saw or did not see, as the case might be, a veteran religious doing or not doing what they should. Consequently, I would say there ought to be provision in each constitution where the religious under final vows are reminded explicitly of their grave obligation binding under sin. Is not even just charity, it's injustice, to give a good example. There might even be at least a reference of the constitutions to some kind of sanction. For example, a religious often in charge, and that's the worst, when it's the superior, or the principal, or the administrator who is giving the bad example. Because that person may be quite necessary for the financial and other well-being of whatever the apostolic enterprise is. Sanction, including transfer to another house, or told, look, father, brother, or sister, unless you watch yourself, for example, take a simple thing like silence. Or unkind talk, or criticism of superiors, or casual behavior during the liturgy, or whatever. If it's habitual, the person should be reminded and, frankly, even told, I will have to change you. Maybe elsewhere where we don't have young religious, where you won't be disedifying people, you might do well. And the excuse of these people can't be, well, tell her to grow up. That's not the answer. The point is she's not grown up. And there's one sense in which a religious should never grow up, as though they are to be able to cope with the most scandalous conduct and not be affected. They're human beings. And the more zealous and serious a religious is, the more sensitive they are to people's example. Is this number nine? I think before they enter into that first profession stage. Now, balance here is necessary, but I think they should be told forthrightly and explicitly I call it forewarned, in order to be forearmed. What to expect. And it's just as well that they might be a little surprised, maybe even shocked, over what they're told before they take their first vows, rather than have them experience afterwards and then not know how to cope with it. Some communities are found it useful. This has to be done carefully, especially during the, say, second year of the novitiate, of maybe a week or two, even a couple of days, of just being. It might cost a little bit in another house, such that they see and hear things. Not that you're out to, you might say, steal them to what they're going to see later on, but just a certain amount of practicality. Number 10. And this, I think, is the hardest part. It's all very well to talk about development of the religious life after first profession. The whole question is, what do we mean by developing the religious life? There are two levels to this development. There is the growth in idealism, but this must be balanced by growth in realism. Candidates for the religious life may be practical individuals, but by and large, and it's almost the nature of grace, they are idealistic people. None of us is a perfect human being except Christ. Cardinal Newman says the hardest balance to achieve in a human being, even in some of the great saints, is a perfect harmony between the ideal and the real. The hopes and desires inspired by God's grace and the down-to-earthness of human nature. They may be too idealistic. Not in an absolute sense, because whatever the virtue we're talking about, God's grace wants us to achieve perfection. That's what we're supposed to be striving after. On the other hand, and this is where each individual must be treated as a person, any one person may have ideals that are unrealistic for that person. Because, first of all, we are different. Now, when we say too idealistic, that isn't even quite correct, because quantitatively, we can never be too idealistic. But qualitatively, take the matter of say of humility. No two people's humility is quite the same. For some people, humility is the withdrawn, silent, hidden kind of spirituality. Now, person B, in whom humility is to take a more overt, active, and sometimes even outspoken form, can be very humble. But they're just the outgoing type. If they get the idea that humility is this withdrawn, hidden, silent, type, then they can be living under what for them, am I making sense? What for them is a false ideal. And that's why each person has to be dealt with individually, and of course, those dealing with them must have a very broad vision and not try to shape, as we all naturally try to do, the persons we deal with to our own image and likeness. For example, I am not the quiet, hidden, non-obtrusive, silent, non-speaking type. It took years for me to learn, and I'm still learning, that I can practice humility and be very outgoing. But I have to have enough sense to know that other people are not like me. And so the silent type, they can be, for example, in charge of formation. And they can crush, I've seen it happen, they can crush the outgoing personality and either squeeze them to a point where they're no longer themselves, or even crush their vocation out of them. And so of all the other virtues. So, with that explanation, the answer is yes. But the too idealistic is never in an absolute sense, because we are to reach. The word ideal is really not a correct word in the spiritual life. We are to reach that measure of perfection that God has in store for us. And we should ambition that.
I think that's that word, idealism, just maybe that's from a personal thought here, I tend to get a little bit sensitive about that terminology because of the fact that I think that religious life today in many communities seem to emphasize so greatly today activism. And when you recall to them the importance of what priorities, prayer life, community life, sacrifice, self-denial, immediately these things are, oh, that's all beautiful, brother, unless you're too idealistic. You have to look at the, you know, we are active, we are involved. Well,
in the real life.
Yes, and of course that's true, but that doesn't justify the fact that we need, where does the balance come in?
Well, this is where I would say there's simply a misuse of language, and people use language, say for example, ideal or idealistic, and they don't really mean what they mean. What they really mean is, I'm not that interested in prayer and the interior life, so don't talk to me about it. And they will hide behind terms like idealism. What they mean is, I don't want to live the real religious life. The interior life is of the essence of realism. In fact, the passage of St. Paul, where he practically says that the only truly real is the spiritual. But this is, you're right, this is part of the secularism in which we are living, which cares very little, if at all, for anything that does not have size, shape, taste, and touch. The sensibly perceptible world. Is this number 10 now?
11.
Superiors in the residence where young religious live should, I think, if not be specially trained, at least should be specially prepared to deal with the newly professed. There is a technique, there is a method. There is some value when some communities do this, when they appoint, especially in a larger house, some one person besides the superior. No trouble. That might almost be a good recommendation. In most cases, it can't be done. And the risk is there may then be conflict between the superior and this quasi-formation person. The second thing regarding the superior, and maybe the most important thing, they must be impressed with the fact that there is nothing more important that they have to do as superiors than to listen to and deal with the often, what in their judgment, is the trivia of these still unformed religious. In other words, superiors may never consider themselves too busy. Whatever else typifies the modern age, it is independence. And consequently, superiors mistakenly will, as they say, not intrude. Let him or her learn for themselves. Well, they will learn all right, but they may learn the wrong things. Now, notice this is, again, the careful balance, but I would say, apart from the word balance, which is always a safe word to use in any context, I think the modern religious, if anything, needs to more and more learn dependence, because I think most modern people are spontaneously independent. And I'm told this from children, or about children, 8, 9 years old. By the way, a very good thing to read, and I hope we can find a copy of last week's U.S. News and World Report. Would we have a copy in the house, sister? It would be very well if we could find a copy. There's a very fine study made by a psychologist from New York on the effect of television on children. One of the finest I've read, and being now we're getting into the media in the apostolate, I have to keep informing myself. But one of the things that he points out is the youngsters are learning premature autonomy years before they can cope with life. They're being told to be themselves. Well, they'll be themselves all right, but Lord help those who have to live with them. It can be the crude, unformed, selfish self. So that superiors have to recognize that, if anything, the average person today wants to be independent and may even resent, at least show some signs of resentment at being told what to do or what not to do.
And in addition to that, it seems that a lot of modern theology today concerning religious life is this word, a very misunderstood word, and that word is maturity. They use that as a justification of independence. In other words, well, I'm a mature person, therefore I can make my own decisions. I'm not a child. When they don't, seemingly, they don't understand what the word maturity means in the religious life, like Mary was fully mature, faith and obedience. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yes. That is so true, and I would say there's no substitute for its absence. And I think in many religions they are immature. But for that very...
Have you ever heard a mature person say that I am mature? I never have.
No, because they recognize honestly that they still have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
For example, that all the years I finished my studies at the age of 37, I'd be out of my mind to say that I am fully educated. And I've heard some whippersnappers. I watch, for example, sometimes I've been in conversation with college sophomores. Just, you're aghast at their self-sufficiency.
Even Pope John said that on his, I think it was either his 80th birthday or something like that. He says, I'm 80 years of age today, he says, and he says, you know something, and I'm still learning, and thank God for it.
Oh, that's so true. At any rate, it's good to know that there are certain issues here and from the earliest years of formation, so that they're not too surprised when they enter the so-called active apostolate. They're not too surprised that they should still be told what to do and what not to do. And I think the biggest problem with obedience is right here too. In other words, the idea of being told what to do is frankly part of intelligent human living, because we don't know all the facts, even though we may be full-grown adults. We have to consult, so that obedience is not such an infantile virtue as some people may think. Any well-run corporation has people who tell others what to do, and for example, the assistant administrator must listen to the administrator. Again, I want to say something about development in each of the three vows. You can see I'm just kind of spreading myself. I hesitate leaving this go because I realize those years are the bridge between the novitiate and those final vows. If this is not taken care of, you're going to have misformed and misshaped religious, if they're real evil, even persevere for the rest of their lives. The virtue of chastity. Let's face it. During the years of the early formations, say postulancy and novitiate, the very nature of the life, the kind of living, the associations, all those things help to preserve one's chastity. The kind of company which the young religious keeps, the things that are seen, even the books, magazines, and newspapers that are available. The persons that are associated with. There is limitation on, normally, on correspondence, right? There's a limitation on travel. All of those things, properly used, are, and they're meant to be, helps to chastity. But once, having taken his or her first vows, and now living in, say, a residence, where those protections or various forms of custody of the senses are not available, the passion is there. It's going to be aroused, and sometimes within months, as a priest I can tell you, chastity can be lost. Indeed, if the person is not careful, or if those who are in charge of the religious are not careful, a person who may never before have sinned gravely against chastity may find himself within the first year or two after first vows
for the first time in their lives. Sinning against chastity. There are so many sex stimuli . Take, for example, the kind of work that has to be done, the people you have to deal with, the place you go, maybe you have to go. In other words, it's almost a shift from the monastic life, which by and large is what most postulancies and novitiates are, at least semi-monastic, to a very, and sometimes unwisely, active apostolic life. And there's such a thing as tempting providence. Brother?
Although each religious, of course, has his own free will and couldn't sin against his will, is it not true that the superior plays a large role in keeping these temptations and stimuli away from the religious?
Very, very much.
Would you say that the superior would have to answer to God eventually before he left?
And I would not hesitate saying, especially if the person had been warned or is otherwise intelligent enough, could even sin gravely. The superior. There is a passage, remember, in the Old Testament, Lord, forgive me and spare me from my hidden sins. Among the hidden sins of which we can be guilty is the sins that other people commit through my negligence. The responsibility that I have to watch over, protect. And no cliches about him or her being mature. Because in this case, and listen to this, a religious, and I'm not sure who is more vulnerable here, whether men or women religious. I believe men religious are more vulnerable. I really think so. Because in many ways, a girl, by the time she enters the religious life, has already had to protect her chastity in so many ways. So she's kind of alert to the things she's got to watch. But for both, the simple fact is that a person who has the grace of a religious vocation, which includes the grace to evangelical chastity, he is highly sensitive. It takes, other things being equal, less to arouse a person who is living this kind of a life than one who is living in the world and he is constantly exposed to these stimuli, and afterwards you never take all of them fully for granted, but some of them you see things, you hear things, and they don't arouse you as much. So there is, I think, a hypersensitivity born of grace, which means hyper-custody. I cannot say to myself that I'm a grown man or woman and therefore I don't have to be all that picayune about either not reading or looking at or dealing with what is sexually stimulating. None of us is confirmed in grace, and most certainly not confirmed in the grace of consecrated chastity. Then, obedience. Obedience in the early years of formation, up to first vows, is generally obedience in rather routine things to which a person, after a couple of months, either decides to resign himself or leaves the community. Getting up at a certain time, going to bed at a certain time, these prayers or that chore well.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.